his credibility worldwide shrinks. Let's get this straight. How would it be if the United States were viewed by the rest of the world as interfering with the elections directly of other countries and everybody knew it? What would it be like if we engaged in activities that he is engaged in? It diminishes the standing of a country that is desperately trying to make sure it maintains its standing as a major world power. And so it's not just what I do. It's what the actions that other countries take, in this case, Russia, that are contrary to international norms. It's the price they pay. They are not able to dictate what happens in the world. There are other nations of significant consequence, i.e. the United States of America being one of them.
Everybody, how's it going? Welcome to this week's episode of Left Reckoning. Interfere who? Us? Plus Canada's school gravesite revelations. We're going to be joined in a little bit by Lance from the Source for a conversation that is really important, and I've been preparing myself for because it's a difficult subject matter. But we have a lot more to talk about too. We're going to be talking about some kind of positive news of a situation that could have happened, an American ground invasion of Bolivia, the Supreme Court continuing its nasty legacy, and much, much more. But as always, I'm joined by my friend Matt Leck. How's it going, brother?
Yeah, it's going okay, David. I mean, just that insane projection. I think I'm not a psychologist, let alone for heads of state like Joe Biden. But the idea that a country thinks it can interfere in other elections and it won't be remedied until other countries come together and say, hey, stop doing that. That's an interesting lesson to see Joe Biden elaborate. But yeah, as you said, we'll get to more about that and a few some mercenary requests that were made by the defense minister of Janine Inez. Is that her first name? So yeah, we'll get to that after Lance from the Serfs talks about the horrific Kamloops residential school grave revelations and how that's not the only residential school, let's just put it that way, and there's sort of a fractal horror to that story. Lance of the they've been covering the story with I think extreme thoughtfulness, and I'm glad to have Lance join us. But first, David, I have a new idea.
You have a little theory, don't you?
We wanted to start because I think I've cracked the code. I've been scrolling on Twitter, like the Matrix, and finally a picture started to emerge of what exactly we all need to do, which is this. I think we need to start a new group. Whatever your groups are in, if you're in DSA, if you're, just at your workplace, start a group that is dedicated to doing things the right way and not doing things that are unproductive or bad. And we need to be really rigid about listing those things and keeping it to it. And I think as long as we hold to those ideals, I think probably we'll have climate change and capitalism sorted 2034-ish.
That makes sense. Instead of trying to grow and to build out, we should make sure, because the problem right now with the left is that it's too big. I think almost anybody, any socialist would agree that the socialist movement is too large. So what we need to be doing is we need to be calling as many
quality assurance
as possible. obviously Matt and I are, you know, messing around a little bit, but we wanted to talk about this, and not by naming any names or like getting fixated on kind of drama, but this has been a big fear that we have had since the end of the Bernie campaign, which is that the American left does what the American left has been very successful at doing, which is falling into extreme factionalism and kind of petty internal fights that might feel very, very important ideologically and philosophically. But when it actually comes to moving the ball forward in class struggle, they don't tend to, you know, really focus and harness our energies in a way that is able to challenge the bosses and the war machine, fight climate change. There's a great essay by Hal Draper, who was one of the great American socialists, called The Anatomy of the Microsect. And I just wanted to quote a little bit from it because I was reading this essay earlier this week, and it was a little frightening to see something that was written in 1973, right? At a period of time when one of the left, the socialist left, was, you know, nowhere near power, anything like that. But it's before the great wilderness, right? It's before these like lost years of politics where, you know, left movements and socialist movements very much either fell into even more sectarian activity or completely, you know, fell into, they basically lost any real connection with the working class in politics in any meaningful way, right? They became book clubs. And there's a lot in this essay that's great, but I want to note his definition of what a sect is, because I think it's a really important way of conceiving of what a sect is. A sect presents itself as the embodiment of the socialist movement, though it is a membership organization whose boundary is set more or less rigidly by the points in its political program rather than by its relation to the social struggle. And this, I think, is really spot on, and we're starting to see the beginnings of, you know, of this rise with a lot of American leftists, a lot of American socialists, where it's a kind of feeling, right, that if we can just find the one true socialism, right, the one pure socialism, if we can come out with a party platform that is perfect in every way, then we will achieve socialism. But I'm going to tell you right now, there are a lot of really smart socialists in our history who came up with really incredible platforms. And man, you start to wish, man, I wish these people were pulling the levers of government and had the way to implement these things to put them into power. What you find more and more is, despite developing, you know, strong, robust critique of American imperialism and American capitalism and getting rid of any member who, you know, questioned these tenets, these organizations were not able to implement the social change that's necessary. And why is that? It's the second part of what Hal Draper is talking about here. It's an organization that's defining itself by the points in its political program rather than by its relation to the social struggle. And this isn't just a nitpicking thing. This is one of the great mistakes that leftists make. And it's even worse now, I would argue, after decades of like neoliberal enculturation for many people, especially our age. Right, of one thinking about politics as a personal individual activity rather than as a member of a collective or a group, or God forbid, a political class, that being the working class, right? Losing that connection to the social struggle means you have abandoned your vehicle. You have abandoned the very thing which you argue as a socialist is going to allow you to achieve victory. We've said this time and time again. Why is the working class important to socialists and to Marxists? Not because it's necessarily the most exploited class or the worst off class or anything like that, right? Certainly, there's a lot of history that can, you know, make that argument, but that's not the reason why it's important to this theory of social change. It's important because labor and workers create the value in society, the vast majority of value in society, right? And because of that specific position in the production process in society, they have the ability to flip this system on its head and create something that is far more beneficial to the masses, is less warlike, and has these veins of, you know, utopian hope of a better future, of a future that is socialized in the most beautiful sense of those terms, that we are able to live in a system where our needs are met and where we are working with one another, right? That's the radical proletarian dream. And it emanates and emerges from the working class. What happens a lot is that socialism, as like, and Marxism in particular, as like a grand social theory, it attracts a lot of, you know, dreamers and people. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? But it attracts a kind of mentality that people spend so much time, you know, trying to paint themselves as a radical or a revolutionary, that they forget that it's not about you as an individual. It's about you as a member of a social class, right? And it's an extremely dangerous mistake to make. And it's one that in this country, which has, unfortunately, a very backward socialist movement, after years and years of heavy-handedness from our opponents, both the ruling class, but also the media and our education system and all of those factors, right? Has been beaten down. And we're falling back into these older mistakes in a way that really worries me.
Yeah, I wanted to bring out, I think, well, a part we both highlighted, an interesting section here. Very few, it's also interesting to me, the tone this is written in, and I wanted to include just some of that. But very few so-called or self-styled Marxists have understood the heart of Marx's approach to to proletarian socialism. The basic strategy for building socialist movement lies in fusing two movements, the class movement for this or that step, which gets a decisive sector of the class into collision with the established powers of the state and bourgeoisie, which is like you were talking about the workers, a collision on whatever scale possible, and the work of permeating this class movement with educational propaganda for social revolution, which integrates the two.
Yeah. And and that's such a phenomenal point there, because he's not saying, and we're not saying, that having robust debate is not important. Hell, a lot of this channel and a lot of the work that we do is about the work of political education. Go and read your Leo Panitch. This is critical work of socialists to do the political education. But for the political education to come to fruition, the point of doing it is not just to sit around and argue about theory and argue about things in books. It's about equipping the people who have the ability to change the system with the tools that they need, right? And that is the role of a socialist movement, of people who are spending time recognizing what's happening in history, what's happening around them, right? So that we can be here when these moments of collision happen to point and say, this is the way, this is the direction that we need to go, right? I mean, to give people like a kind of concrete example of this, if you spent any time protesting or marching, right? You know what it's like to be in a movement or a march that has direction versus one that doesn't, right? There's that moment people come out in the streets and they want to display their dissatisfaction, right? But then there's those moments where you take the people in the street and you do something with them, right? You shut something down, or you make some kind of point, or, you know, a spectacle that brings more and more people in the movement, right? You know what it's like when you're in a march or a movement or of that nature, when there is some form of direction. And that is the role of socialists in these kind of movements and moments. But there has been this development of a kind of socialist that doesn't recognize the importance of organization and of being rooted in their class. Rather, they think that just by sitting outside of society, they're going to be able to build something different. I'll tell you right now, the people who benefit the most from this society, this oppressive society, are very happy for the kind of lifestyle socialists rather than organizers and embedded socialists. But before we even, because honestly, I know we have to get to Lance, but I wanted to make this point too, because Matt and I were talking before we got on. And the thing that is sort of frustrating about this moment right now is, while we're talking about the problem with like sects and like sectarianism, right? In a lot of ways, what we're seeing right now is like, we're not even seeing a sectarian movement, because we're not seeing people who are members of organizations really being the ones behind a lot of the issues. We're seeing like a kind of like pre-sectarian movement. And what I mean by that are people who are not in political organizations or not involved in this work, but are actively consuming and watching a lot of politics and a lot of things that are going on, spending their time trying to derail or prevent any kind of new formation from coming into being by constantly pointing out, you know, some problem, real or perceived, with these. That is like an advanced form of American political neurosis that we really need to squash out. And did you squash it out by inviting people in and trying to like have, you know, outward facing, bring people in movements. But we also need to start calling this thing out because it's not achieving the victories or the goals that a lot of people think that it is.
Yeah, you know, it. I get a lot of, in this past year, I've gotten, every once in a while you get somebody says, or you see a comment saying, yeah, I've moved to the left of your content, Matt Leck. And there's a couple, two kinds I would categorize those. One is the one I've really no problem with, the person who is like gone and like, I'm not really watching YouTube politics at all. I'm actually doing something in my community, whether it's like trying to form a union or, you know, joining DSA or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the other group of people who think that, like, they'll tell me the new shows and that they're supporting on Patreon as if like that's moving to the left. And that is an expression of American consumerism, just completely perverted to the point where literally your political identity is what you consume.
And it's individual too.
Yes.
And that's the really dangerous aspect of it as well. No, I think, exactly. And I think that's like a, you know, very, very true point. And even beyond that, I mean, not to be too hot takey, but I think a big part of this does come out of the fact that so much of the left and our infrastructure came out of the Bernie Sanders movement, which was, again, what we needed to do. It was a Hail Mary. But it was definitely an important moment, one, at bringing a lot of people into politics, clarifying a lot of people's politics, and showing people that there are alternatives out there. But one of the issues, I think, with organizing around a presidential campaign is that you attract a lot of eyeballs, right? But because, you know, there's American presidential campaigns are such spectacles, we also taught a lot of people that like a lot of like left-wing activity is like observing. Right? Because like, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of people who are out knocking on doors for Bernie Sanders, but because of the very nature of campaigns in the United States, the Bernie Sanders phenomenon was a lot of times it's like, well, come into a town near you, right? You're watching it happen in Iowa. It's like, oh, maybe it's going to come to my town eventually. And some people got to experience that, right? If they were in an early primary state, a lot of people didn't. And I think that also sort of, you know, created a dynamic where more people, their engagement into this alternative was only through viewing, right? But
yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, I noticed that in 2008, Obama, he visited North Dakota, and he didn't win North Dakota, obviously. But like, he didn't perform bad, and he crushed in Minnesota. But but people in like Fargo, Moorhead, on the border of North Dakota, Minnesota, that was huge that like a whole bunch of people went up, drove the interstate to go watch him speak there. And like, and I mean, you also see that, again, this is still spectacle, right? But actually going there. And I mean, I think the way to do this, we have to do this outside of presidential elections where you notice what the left is doing in your community, outside of, you know, like, the press or social media.
Exactly. And, you know, and again, this is not a criticism. This is just like looking at the history. This is not a criticism of that. Those are the limitations of what happened, right? I mean, that's just what happened. It's not like, oh, you're fucked up because this is how you got into it, right? Just saying this is like how it happened. And we need to understand that to build out of that, we need to understand where some of those limitations are. And I know we're running out of time. So maybe we'll do more about this and maybe I'll spend some time on the next, you know, stream on Tuesday. But you know, I think another thing that's really important for people to recognize is that while a lot of the working class is a part of like the left, the socialist left, as we call it, they are not necessarily interchangeable things. And I think sometimes people make the mistake of seeing what the left is doing and mistaking that for what the working class is doing. And to bring it back to that original formation that Hal Draper puts forward, you know, what the socialists need to be doing, what socialists need to be doing is looking for parts in society, places in society where there are collisions between the ruling class and the working class, and using those moments to build viable political alternatives and organizations that can harness the energy and the dreams and the desires and the wants of the working class towards positive social movement.
Absolutely. Before we break here, I just want to throw a little bit of a plug to the Patreon. Patreon Left Reckoners will have been treated to a conversation between David and I and history professors at Missouri State University, Gene Bajelon, who this audience should be familiar with, and John Graham, about the 1776 Project Commission propaganda campaign, anti-communist documents, basically slaver apologetic document that really, like, as part of this, what we're seeing about CRT, critical race theory, and this sort of panic about the discourse that we're seeing from the right, which is, you know, common. This is what happens in this country. This is what McCarthyism was. And instead of social media, it was Hollywood back then. But this is what happens when you have a new information field available to people. Is it needs to be disciplined by capitalists and white supremacy. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning, and we'll be back in a couple minutes with Lance from the Serfs. See you folks then. All right, and welcome back, Matt Leck. Joining me, as always, David Griscom is here, and joining me, I'm pleased to welcome Lance of the Serfs. I guess that's how I know you, is Lance of the Serfs. I want to say, like, I've known of the Serfs for a while. I saw shares before this, but they came really to my attention during the debacle where YouTube removed your YouTube page. And ever since then, what was that?
It was April Fool's 2 years ago. Y'all saved us, by the way. The Majority Report was one of the big things that really propelled that story into the mainstream that helped get our channel back. So thank you enough.
I think Left YouTube really came together on that. And ever since then, I've noticed the channel grow and grow. And as not only is it one of the most engaging shows, I think, in this field, but also you guys do some of the most thoughtful stuff, which is not entirely incentivized, I think, in this field. So I just appreciate you for that. And everybody who was not a subscriber should go check out the Serfs Times on YouTube, right? And then there's the Serfs TV on Twitch and Twitter.
Easiest way to find us is just weareserfs.com has a link to everything there. So weareserfs.com, because we have a lot of little mini channels now. We have Serfs at the Cinema, where I make fun of really shitty movies, typically Christian films, and have a little laugh.
So. Oh, that's great. I want to, let's start this off. Kamloops 215, that's a combination of words that people have seen maybe scroll past a ticker if you're not familiar with the indigenous community. I would recommend you go look at a lot of the interviews that have been done with survivors of these schools and the sort of dark rumors coming to be realized about the schools that they had to live with. And so, but for people who this is just, they've just seen the number 215 and these residential school grave sites, give us the context that we need to understand this and what actually happened at this school and residential schools across Canada.
Yeah. So don't feel bad if you didn't know about any of this, because a recent poll just came out showing that 2/3 of Canadians didn't even know about this, which is kind of disgusting, because it should be a part of our public education system. It is not. I was not taught it in the public education system in Canada. I was taught it because my mother happens to be Métis, and she was always trying to instill a little bit of Indigenous history in me and my brother's lives. But yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, the residential school system in Canada started thanks in large part to our founding Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, and put a footnote on that because I'm going to rip into him a little bit later in this broadcast. And the idea behind the residential school system was that there was obviously a large Indigenous population in Canada, and they wanted to, quote, remove the Indian from within. So the idea was that they would take children from their families, and they would do it literally. They would steal children from their mother's arms and their dad's arms, and then forcibly put them into these institutions called residential schools. There was 139 residential schools across the entirety of the country, and each one of these was originally run by the Catholic Church and eventually was taken over by the government of Canada themselves and then run by the government of Canada. And they were horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. Like there's no easy way to sugarcoat what the residential school system was like. It was systematic torture of children. They would remove their language, so they would have to unlearn any indigenous language they already knew, and then they would have to learn either French or English as a replacement. They would lose their names, whatever indigenous names they already had. They were given proper Catholic names. They would lose their history, their culture, everything, and then they would have to learn basically Canadian and Western indoctrination as a result. That's just on the surface level. That's kind of the nice things. I mean, nice in quotation marks. What was actually happening on top of that was huge amounts of rape. Thousands and thousands of children were raped by Catholic priests and nuns. Huge amounts of torture. The most horrifying residential school in Canada actually had an electric chair where they were electrocuting children. Yeah. And what happened recently was a satellite imagery photo showed at this residential school in Kamloops, which has been closed since like the 1970s, I believe, showed that there was children buried underneath it, 215 kids to be exact. So that's where this whole thing kind of blew out of proportion and suddenly became world news, because it was the first time a lot of people had heard about this. To the families of those kids, the parents were told that their children ran away. That was more often than not the story that was told to all these indigenous families, that their kids just ran away, when in reality, they were either tortured, murdered, or let die for a variety of reasons, and they were burying children underneath the schools in mass graves. Like straight Nazi shit, you know? Mm-hmm. It's this dark, untold part of Canadian history that was happening, again, at a governmental level. This was done by the government of Canada. It was overseen. The Act, which is called the Indian Act, which I know the term Indian is obviously antiquated, but the Indian Act of Canada still remains to this day. Obviously, it's been updated a handful of times, but it's still very much a real part of Canadian history.
That's the thing about the nature of the schools, like you talked about, and we have, and maybe we can get into this too about the boarding schools in America, but like the violence of just the cultural violence of, and I believe the phrase common I've heard is kill the Indian, save the man, right? Like that's the philosophy behind these schools. So even like the people who weren't murdered and then their families told they were ran away, you are undergoing this incredible violence. I don't know if you have any comment on that part. And is there, I guess we also, maybe we're skipping a little bit ahead, but like we have this history of boarding schools in America, and a lot of the American Indian movement folks in the 70s had mm-hmm. scars similar from those schools. Do we know, like, we obviously know the cultural impact, and maybe we just don't know. I'm not familiar with like maybe the murder history of the American side that we're uncovering about the Canadian side, but I was just curious if you have any info on that.
I can explain a little bit with the reservation system in the U.S. What effectively happens is people think of indigenous people as a monolith, obviously, right? Like, and always have. The reality of it was that there was thousands of different indigenous cultures, as well as like in Canada, they're called bands. In the U.S., they're called tribes. But each one of them had their own dialect, their own language, their own history, their own culture, their own beliefs. And what the reservation system did in the U.S. is they would squish them all together and place them in these small little concentrated impoverished areas. And then surprise, surprise, years of abuse, neglect would result in things like high levels of alcoholism, high levels of drug abuse, all that kind of stuff. Very similar to the system in Canada with the reservation system here. And the problem when you were talking about the culture and how it affected all these indigenous children is that in indigenous cultures, there is no written language. There's no books. There's nothing. It's all an oral history. So every single generation would pass one culture's lessons, history, all that stuff to the next through what were called storytellers. Storytellers would be the person within the band who would be tasked with the job of, again, learning all the previous history, language, culture, passing on to the next one. So with the reservation system in Canada, effectively destroyed so much of that. When they removed things like the language and the culture from the kids, they also lost their history. And what little is left and preserved is still a fraction of once was, or what once was, and we'll never ever know any of that, right? Because it's just, it's lost the time now as part of the cultural genocide that occurred.
Yeah, one of the artifacts of that I've noticed in researching, especially North Dakota area native tribes, is a lot of those documents you can find about their those culture were made by the U.S. Army for reasons not to preserve it, basically.
I was just, I'm sorry, I just like, when it comes to the language question, it's just such a terrible, you know, project that has unfortunately just really, really deep roots in like English colonialism all around the world, even on the islands itself, from the Welsh children who weren't allowed to speak Welsh as well. Obviously not the same kind of context of colonization and genocide there, but it's just, it's such a deep rooted and like, well, like they've created a system. They had a system that was just so deeply rooted and had been like perfected over time to just eradicate, you know, cultures. And what we're talking about right now about losing the history, just there's a line that I remember from Russell Means talking about an elder member of their community about what it was like to lose their language, and is saying it's like they've taken the taste out of my mouth.
That's really sad. All of this is really sad. By the way,
I know. I'm sorry. I've been trying to prepare myself
for this because topics, it makes me and they're so always sad. Yeah, I know. And when they bring me on, they're always like, hey, by the way, like, Lance, you're the silly guy, right? Like, you do comedy. I'm like, well, yeah, but we're going to talk about some of the most horrifying events in human history for about an hour. Like, I don't know how I could make the Holocaust funny, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, you start off the video, the most, or what is the title I want to, on the Surf's Times, I want to plug it, maybe I'll put it in the Horrifying Treatment of Indigenous Canadians on the Surf's Times, with just, like, we need to be not afraid to call this genocide, right? Yeah. Like, we had this, you know, we had that clip of the Israeli settler that everyone was sharing about saying, you know, if it wasn't me, it'd be somebody else. And and like that's shocking to everybody, but to send your descended from settlers in this continent, you have a similar dynamic that you have to own historically. I feel like.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. I totally agree. And like one of the most unfortunate parts about trying to talk about this is trying to do justice. Like we had a huge problem in Canada where conservatives, and they're still doing it to this day, have refused to use the term genocide, right? They've been like, well, I mean, it's horrifying. We're not going to deny that, obviously. I mean, this is a really bad thing, but to call it a genocide, I mean, that's kind of an aggressive terminology, right? The shitty thing, and I don't think people realize, and I have to emphasize this point, is that it's ongoing. This is the thing. And like, we can bring up land back a little bit in the land back movement later.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have some thoughts on that as well. But in Canada, for example, in 2008, it was revealed that there's a class action lawsuit being put forward by a lot of Indigenous women because under the public health care system of Canada, they have been forcibly sterilized. Many times when they were seeking medical attention or medical help, it would be done in response to, by the way, you should probably have like a hysterectomy, or you should probably have something else that prevents you from having children, because we don't want the undue burden anymore of having to deal with all these Indigenous problems and Indigenous kids, stuff like that. That is happening right now. A couple of weeks ago, right at the same time the Kamloops story broke about the 215 kids, it was revealed in British Columbia that young girls, and I'm talking girls, we're talking ages 10 to 13, were forcibly getting IUDs inserted into them, again, under the provincial healthcare program. So this is eugenics. And again, this is happening right now. Like this is not a sordid history of our past. This is not like, this is active right now. So that's what people really have to realize when you use the term genocide. It's not heavy-handed. It's not heavy. Like it's not front-loaded. It's accurate. It is describing what is happening right now.
Yeah, there'd be less sensitivity to it probably if it wasn't active. Really, I looked at the 150 years since the Dakota War, where the Minnesota settlers expelled the Sioux. And that was just, you know, you look at the way that their Sioux were confined, or the Dakota were confined on the Minnesota River. Like those maps look a lot like shrinking Palestinian territory. And ultimately you see violence lash out, and then it's, oh, look at this. Look at this violence. Now we need to exterminate these people, basically, is the logic of it. And yeah, I think that was well put.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're talking about Sue, by the way, I should plug Lost Sue, spelled L-O-S, like Lost, like the word Sue, spelled like S-I-O-U-X, twitch.tv/LostSue, an Indigenous content creator who's very unknown. But if you want to help support Indigenous content creators, go check out Lost Sue on Twitch. She's a streamer who does really good work.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's actually use that as a... We should be following more Indigenous. There's, you know, I also like the Lakota Law Project does a lot of great work. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Sue, let's move a little bit to you had a great we had a great DM where you sort of outlined the centrality of Indigenous resistance to sort of leftist goals in this country. If you could give us that.
Yeah. So when people hear the term land back, I think, and especially on the left, this is like a huge empty or a hollow spot. I don't understand why people take such offense to it. Mm-hmm. As if somehow the idea behind it is like, go back to fucking Europe, you settlers, you know. Or there's also a big problem, I think, just online with the term online, like myself or just everyone calling each other settlers, like, you know, the Spider-Man meme kind of stuff. Yeah, right. All that stuff, like all the memes aside, what land back is essentially fighting for and why I think it's incredibly valid and why the left should unilaterally support it is that in Canada, for example, there was a whole bunch of treaties that were signed between Westerners who came over here, typically British or French colonizers, and the Indigenous people who lived on the land. And these treaties were signed and agreed to by both parties. And oftentimes it was in order to help each other. A lot of the early history of Canada was actually the history of the fur trade, and a large portion of the country was actually owned by a corporation called the Hudson Bay Company. So around those times, they needed a lot of assistance from Indigenous groups when they weren't fighting or trying to basically enslave them or stuff like that. They would need them in order to find different like areas and stuff. So they were signing a lot of treaties with them. Those treaties and the essence of them stated that you have autonomy over this region or district. So this is your land, your country. You have sovereignty over it. You can govern it how you will. This is our area. This one is what we are going to call Canada, or you know, the British Empire at the time. And that is the agreement that we both have. The treaties were signed. And then fast forward to hundreds of years later, where they are actively, again, genociding the people who live on that land and forcibly forcing them to live on reservations and or oftentimes just plowing through the region they live in with oil pipelines or whatever it is, right? So when the land back movement, what they're essentially asking for is the recognition of those treaties that have already been agreed upon. And the reason that it's not only valid and it's a great thing to fight for is because, A, it's being recognized by the Supreme Court of Canada. So when these things have gone to trial or stuff like that, more often than not, the Indigenous people have won. This is a little bit of hopium for everybody. There's a lot of great historical cases in Canada in which the Indigenous people have won back the land and autonomy over their own areas, but it still gets forced upon by the government of Canada. So we have the RCMP here, which is basically, if you've ever seen the Mounties or the memes, I'm sure Dudley Doolittle, you all know what they look like. That's basically the state power, the state cops who enforce the corporate interests of a lot of individual energy companies. So they will often want to say, put oil pipelines through Indigenous land. And when Indigenous people say, well, we don't agree to that, we have sovereignty over our own lands. When it comes to battle, all of a sudden the RCMP come over and they will arrest them and force them to have to, you know, subject them to whatever tyranny they're asking for. So that's why, sorry, this is a really long-winded answer, but that's why land back is an important thing, and it's a virtuous thing to fight for. If you look at National Geographic, they put forward a study that showed that while making up only 5% of the global population, Indigenous peoples are responsible for 80% of global biodiversity protection. 80%. And like, look no further than somewhere like Brazil, for example, where Indigenous guerrilla fighters are literally dying in the Brazilian rainforest to try and preserve what little is left there, while Bolsonaro is trying to bulldoze and inflame the entire region. So Indigenous peoples are the ones who are actually trying to defend the planet and keep us all alive. So it's also in your best interests to allow them to have their land back, because they're probably going to protect it, you know, yeah. Unlike the rest of us.
Yeah, I would just bring up a couple sort of practicalities on that, like, because there is, like you said, the fear of what does this mean? Am I going to have to get on a boat and go back to, you know, Czechoslovakia or something? But, you know, Nick Estes had a great piece in The Guardian about bringing up Bill Gates and the amount of land he owns, which, I mean, that's a great place to start. Also, Anton Trier had one about the national park should be under tribal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And then not to mention all the pieces of land that you're talking about that are complete, like, legally, because we have the exact same dynamic in the States, where just like treaties, many of them just completely fraudulent that shouldn't have any really standing with tribes. But anyway, allotted a certain amount of land because we needed to, like, to some cooperation so we could exploit stuff better, get the Oregon Trail through or whatever, right? And it's exactly, yeah. And it's not like, let's just kick all these residents out. It's, hey, you know that land that the government owns because it's that repossessed because of taxes, that should be ours? Give that to us now. And it's like, there's all these very actual practical steps that, and I don't want to speak for anyone who has more radical a land back position, but it has been thought through more than maybe your paranoid settler response might lead you to believe.
Well, there's no indigenous bands in Canada asking for, like, white people to have to leave the country. Like, the majority of Canadians all live near the border. Like, this is way more about stop killing us. that's kind of what the land.
Let's have water.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, give us clean drinking water. Like, there's, I think, over 60 reservations in this country that still don't have potable water, which is incredibly fucked up for how rich this country is. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, it's like people act like they might just have wisdom such as don't trust those engineers that just tell you that they can put a pipe through this stuff and it's never going to leak, right? Like I don't know. It gets a little bit true.
And I'd just be curious to understand the dynamics of, like, the Canadian system, because, like, one of the things that's really difficult here in the U.S. right now is, like, we went through a period of termination, right, which just destroyed tribes, obviously, and that goes through another period of residential schools or boarding schools, right? And then we go through, like, Nixon of all people, but only because he was literally forced to entering into the period of time of self-determination, right? And there's this really difficult, like, two-tiered status that Native tribes have here in the U.S. where it's like, are you a federally recognized tribe, or are you a state recognized tribe, or are you just in some other kind of third category? And, like, one of the big ones here, big fights here that happened in Virginia was over the Pamunkey people, right, who did not have federal recognition, and they were trying to achieve federal recognition. And because of, like, Virginia's super racist history, they tried to argue it. And by the way, all the lawyers who are arguing against it were paid for by, you guessed it, a big American casino interest, because they're worried if the Pamunkey got, control over their land, that they might, create an alternative to whatever the hell they're doing up in Maryland, right? Anyway, that they basically argued that because the Pamunkeys in, like, the 30s or 40s were categorized as white, in the Virginia census, that they're not native peoples anymore. And it's been a huge ongoing fight. I only bring this up to say, like, this matters a lot. These legal distinctions in the U.S. where, you have people who, there are tribes that people are very familiar with. And then there's some smaller tribes that are fighting for federal recognition today that still don't have that. Mm-hmm. And I know it's like there's similar kinds of fights as well. Right.
Yeah, no, there is. I mean, if you bring that up, like, my mom's indigenous heritage it's called Métis. And if you don't know about them in Canada, historically, they're a combination of either Scottish or, in the case of my mother, French and Cree people. They can also other indigenous cultures. But in the history of Canada, they were pretty fucking badass, because they were obviously a huge amount of colonizers who had come over, and they started marrying indigenous women. That produced thousands and thousands of these Métis people who were known as the half-breeds in Canada. And they were responsible for these massive rebellions in the country that ended up forging like the province of Manitoba. It wouldn't exist without the Red River Rebellion, for example, stuff like that. But there's always been that problem, and they had a long time without being recognized in this country for the simple reason, like, yeah, I mean, if you look at me, I'm as white as the driven snow, like I'm as a creamy mayonnaise cracker as it gets. Right. So I can understand completely. Like I have every white passing privilege you can imagine, even though, like, my father was, he's Catalonian. He was born in Chile, and my mother happens to be indigenous, but, like, I can see exactly why there would be a difference between trying to recognize at a state level people who don't appear on the surface to be indigenous enough, right? That's where we get into the whole like blood quantum aspect of the history of all this. But that's pretty fucked up. I didn't know about that story, especially involving the casino interests.
Oh yeah, I mean it's a huge here because obviously there's so much money in it.
I mean, Jack, can I just say that on the Pamunkey just quickly? Like Pamunkey were the idea that they would be classified as white when I only know this because I went in deep in Bacon's Rebellion history, but the Pamunkeys were one of the key trading allies of the Virginia sort of settlement. And then Bacon turned on them and basically hunted them down because he basically said, there are no friend Indians. Like it was the terms he said. They're all enemies. I lost my train of thought, but on the other thing I wanted to bring up, but yeah, where should we go from here? Do you guys want to bring something up?
Oh, I just like if we're talking about, you know, difficulties with dealing with the federal government, even when you think things are settled, you know, one thing that's really difficult, and I can't remember, like across like 5G towers, for example, you know, tribes that are in the United States are trying to protect like their heritage and holy sites. They're responsible under current laws. And I think this was a Trump administration policy to basically, if, you know, Verizon wants to build a 5G tower wherever, they have to, you know, they have to basically investigate it. They get a claim from the company and they have like 2 months to respond, right? But because organizations like Verizon and Sprint or whatever, like are building towers at like an alarming rate, and you have tribes that don't have a lot of money, don't have a lot of resources, they're basically just getting flooded with requests when obviously this requirement for paying for investigation should be on the multi-billion dollar telecommunications companies that are allowed to be a monopoly by this corrupt American system, right? No, instead they're, you know, the costs of this are foisted on like, you know, tribes that are just barely getting by for the most part to be able to investigate, you know, all across from like Texas to South Carolina, you know, from like where they are currently to, you know, traditional homelands. It's just, you know, these like these questions of sovereignty, I just bring this up because one thing that a lot of liberals like to make fun of is like when President Bush said sovereignty means sovereignty, which is very funny because it's like Bush was obviously a dumbass, right? And obviously any reasonable person would recognize that sovereignty means sovereignty. But, you know, so it was a good answer, honestly, right? Because that's at least would be the position that I would advocate. But obviously it was toothless, right? And I think a lot of times in the U.S., like there are these horrific examples of, you know, the current crisis right now of missing young girls across, you know, reservations. There's the, you know, poverty rate, alcoholism, all of these other things. And then there are all these like legitimate kind of like legalistic issues that might individually might seem like, oh, that's bad, but it's not, you know, the worst thing I could imagine, right? These are all just like, you know, little chinks that are set up, you know, in the armor to just completely eradicate the concept of sovereignty for tribes that had negotiated these hundreds of years ago, very clearly with the United States and Canadian government.
And, yeah, absolutely. If you want to comment on that, I remember where I got sidetracked because when you mentioned the Métis history, I read a book a while ago because I'm from North Dakota, share a border with Manitoba. Had no conception of the Métis struggle and like the formation of that province. I read a book and I can't really recommend it because I don't have the expertise on it, but it's called The Audacity of His Enterprise, Louis Riel and the Métis Nation That Canada Never Was by M. Max Hamon. And that I was just amazed by how much like the Red River Rebellion, like I went to college on the Red River. I sandbagged it flooding numerous times while there. And I had no idea of any of this history until basically like I was spurned by the Dakota Access Pipeline fight several years ago to like get serious about the history of the plains. But anyways, I think we've kept you probably for a little over time, Lance, but we could have gone longer, I'm sure, at least on our end. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, do you want me to? I can quickly plug if you're talking about that, a book that I'm reading right now. I'm not normally someone who I don't read enough graphic novels. I should, but I just started. This is called Louis Riel, a comic strip biography by Chester Brown. The art and cartooning in it is absolutely darling. The whole thing is wonderful, but it is such a fascinating read about this exact topic that we're talking about the Red River Rebellion, and Louis Riel himself, who is a fascinating figure in Canadian history, because he's wild. He's like, he thought he heard the voice of God talking to him. Like, he was just outrageous, kind of one of those historical figures. And apparently, and I don't know if this is true, my mom likes to say that one of his sharpshooters is our like great, great, great grandfather or something like that. I don't know if that's real. I cannot confirm that. But she likes to tell us that. But anyways, fascinating part of history.
Very good.
And well, I was going to say, thank you so much for not only having me on, but letting me talk about this, because I think it's a really important topic that doesn't necessarily get the clicks. I can tell you from making like 5 videos on this so far, they are my least popular ones. It makes way more sense to rip into Charlie Kirk's giant head or things like that, but they are important to be told, so I really appreciate you giving me the time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your work, and also tell us about the orange shirts before you go.
If you want to help support the movement to be able to help survivors of the residential school program, because right now in Canada, the neoliberal government of Justin Trudeau, our Black Prime Minister, has spent more money than his Conservative predecessor fighting Indigenous survivors in court to be able to get reparations for what happened. He spent over $100 million battling them in court. So residential school survivors and their families will feel the repercussions of this entire ordeal probably until the end of time, because it's just, unfortunately, one of those things that just travels from family to family to family. So if you want to help support residential school survivors, you can get in on the Orange Shirt program. My only caveat is please buy them from Indigenous artists and buy them from Indigenous families and or Indigenous shirt providers. They are more expensive, I won't lie. I just spent like $60 getting one shipped. But at the end of the day, it's considered a donation, because most of them, 100% of the proceeds are going directly to benefit residential school survivors. So it's a really important thing. I sent Matt a link to a Twitter thread that has like, I think 10 or 15 of them. So I'm sure he could hand that out to everyone. I've also retweeted it on my Twitter if you want to check it out. Twitter.com/TheSurfSteam.
Yep, check our description in YouTube, folks. And Lance, thanks again.
Thank you so much. It was a blast.
See you around.
All right, that's great. Yeah, check out the Surfs on all the channels. They're very good at getting out there, and they do some good work.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, David. Man. Yeah, let's see if we can. Do you want to take? We can just keep rolling, or do you want to take a little break?
Yeah, no, we can keep rolling. Just give me 1 second as I'm like collecting my thoughts. You know, it's. It's so disgusting to see what Trudeau's doing. And it reminds you of what Obama, you know, was like, where, you know, there was a lot of hope with Obama that he was going to be, you know, a kind of radical shift, you know, for the tribes. And obviously Trump was a monster in office, but it's just, these kind of federal fights are just so terrible and they're ongoing. You know, it's amazing that how easy it is for liberals to talk about, you know, sovereignty and righting wrongs of history. But the second there's uranium or copper, for God's sake.
Yeah, Thacker Pass, I believe, in Nevada we have. Mm-hmm. We also have the Line 3 in northern Minnesota. We haven't really touched on that extraction part of it.
No, we definitely need to. I mean, yeah. And you know, it's just, you know, my point about you know, bringing up like the English and the just like these relations are just so entrenched in colonial history, right? That like even after you know, there's independence for like the United States and Canada, they're still deeply rooted. I mean, look at you know, in Peru, what happened with Fujimori. I mean, that was one of our big claims against them, and that kind of political process was mass sterilization of Indigenous people, right? You know, these fights, even something that might seem, you know, local, right, in the sense of like Indigenous people, are very much global fights, because the treatment is almost universal across the globe.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I almost hesitate to even start talking about it because it requires research to not miss any instances of that in stateside eugenics, and not against just only indigenous people, but also black, Latino, it literally has formed the world that we're in now, and has the struggles that we have to fight.
Should we do SCOTUS first, or should we do Bolivia first?
I'd say Bolivia.
Yeah, let's do Bolivia. I mean, let's talk about, some good news, and obviously very much connected to this fight as well, about what happened here with, there is no doubt about it, that the pushing back and the defeat of this right-wing coup, even though it took a while, in Bolivia is probably one of the best, the most inspiring stories of the past couple of years. But it's worthwhile, and I think Matt can take us through this a little bit, remind people, and even now we're getting more evidence of just how much worse things could have gotten, despite already being extremely bad.
Yeah, so we have the story here from The Intercept. I'm going to share. Bolivian ex-minister of defense plotted a second coup using U.S. mercenaries. And let me just give you some of the dramatis personae here. So first we have Luis Fernando Lopez. He's a former paratrooper and businessman, and Inez named him defense minister last fall. And we also have Joe Pereira, a civil administrator with the U.S. Army and organizer of this mission, basically these requests, who boasts of links to U.S. special forces. And the overall, basically, Intercept found these recordings, and the request was things like this defense minister saying, we are trying to fight the annihilation of our country by this democratic process that brought Arce to power. And so we are going to, coordinate. We're going to tell the police and military that just stand down when we bring in C-130 Hercules planes from Miami filled with mercenaries, 10,000, which else is commented later that a little bit far fetched some of these numbers. Maybe think a little bit too grandiose. Some Bay of Pigs style delusion maybe by these guys. Ultimately, Arce won and they didn't pull the coup off. But the amount of you have this defense minister saying people will say 95 to 98% of the high level military people will accept a coup here. There might be a few MAS people, but otherwise we're good to go. And it should be for anybody who doesn't remember, Morales was intimidated through violence, paramilitary violence, out of office in the first place. Right. So this is just literally a more brazen.
When the generals ask you to leave.
Right. And people are getting what was it? The Intercept has this at the end of the story. Was it 19 people died? 19 demonstrators were shot dead over the course of that. So it's Morales could have held on and let them just murder more and more demonstrators. But he got intimidated, out of office. And ultimately it turned out well, because he didn't commit fraud. That was exposed, and then Arce won. And I think this sort of reaction, the coup reaction, coup studies, that's going to be a big part of left wing politics, I think, probably for the next 10 or 20 years.
I mean, I think that's I like that. It's a very hopeful way to frame it. It's this is a really beautiful. It's beautiful might be the wrong word, because it's horrific and there's a lot of pain and suffering, but this was a coup that was successfully thwarted. This was a horrible right-wing reactionary movement that came into power briefly, but was not able to maintain it. And it was because of the richness of the social movements, the righteousness of the left, and the fact that it was just completely absurd, the allegations of electoral fraud.
You hear the reaction from military or U.S. sort of side people, and it's this is the last thing this area needs, which is to me seems a little bit too conditional. Like, actually, there might be times where this is the medicine that it needs, but just right now is not the opportune times to send in a Blackwater 2 to say, hey, we're going to just undo this election, which was making up for a coup election under a year ago.
I mean, it's so funny, you know, to read the kind of messages that are being sent back and forth, though, in this Intercept article, to see, like, there's like a little bit of initial appetite, but as things start to develop, you know, the Americans who are just so callous and cold and cruel, you know, just start to realize, though, that despite all their desires to get involved, that it seems like the, you know, the people who want more and more U.S. military forces there are a little full of it.
That's the only way that any of this happens globally, is that the people are too much, because they will try to fuck it. Like, the forces of reaction are conspiring all the time. And somebody who's arrested now for it said that Trump approved it. Now, whether Trump approved it or not, Trump is approving of it, as is like the general U.S. empire, which is to say they might not have signed specific papers. And they might have been concerned about, you know, basically the guy said, we don't want to look like we're supporting this, but if maybe mercenaries flew out of Miami, military base, then that's a little bit better, right? But it's like they want to do it, and we have the infrastructure to invade stuff with new planes, but ultimately, like Bolivia, all these places, you need to get to the point where they can't have that option, even though they wish it was on the in the cards, basically.
No, exactly. And, you know, just one more thing, too, is that you start to see just how much, you know, of a peppering in the United States there are of, like, Bolivians who are willing to make war on their own country in order to make sure that the democratic will wasn't respected, which should be a good reminder for all of the folks who were sort of bamboozled by, you know, Bolivian Twitter accounts that were started right as the coup was beginning, that mainly tweeted in English about, like, the cruelty of Morales. You know, that if there was appetite for people to be showing up with, you know, planes and tanks and guns, there's certainly going to be people who are going to be willing to, you know, to tweet and mislead folks. Absolutely. Which is just another good lesson for people to remember, because it's almost, you know, it's a little bit of a joke on our side, but, like, it is incredible how quickly those forces present themselves on, like, social media as, like, oh no, I'm, like, I'm actually, like, the true authentic voice of all of these, you know, people, and we actually want the United States to come and invade my country and overthrow democracy. You know, people, I think, are starting to realize that a lot of that is BS.
Yeah, there needs to be an update on, remember that, I never read it, but the dictator's learning curve that came out, which is about how dictators are adapting to, like, social media and stuff like that.
No.
But, like, there needs to be, like the Empire's burner account or something like that, where you get all these, like it's always, yeah, like, on demand, people say, I got into this with a bunch of El Salvadorian accounts, or, like, people who are, like, saying, actually, this is going to help me on remittances, the Bitcoin stuff, right? And, like, my point is, one, I don't know if that will scale up. It's still a sliver of remittances. And Bitcoin, my problem, from my understanding, has a problem with scale. Mm-hmm. But if you can use it to get around banks' fees for a while, like, Godspeed. But, like, that is not, I don't think, why a lot of these people are supporting Bitcoin, for instance. But maybe I'm digressing a little bit.
And maybe as a last point here, I just want to say about Bolivia, and I'll say it time and time again, that if you look at what's been happening since Mas has come back into power, there has been a focus on not just reforming the military, but purging it of pro-right-wing forces, of reshuffling and fundamentally reorganizing both the police force and the military. And there's some people in the U.S., U.S. leftists, who don't recognize why this is a critical thing to do when you have the ability to do it. I'm sorry, look at what happened over this past year. Look at the main perpetrators of this system. It wasn't popular movements. It was a super wealthy elite backed by international capital and U.S. interests using not necessarily like the people on the ground, the everyday rank and file of the army, but the elites, people high up in these systems. So of course you need to eradicate those kind of things. And people need to recognize that it's something that is extremely important. And almost every left-wing project that has had serious threats of, you know, coup attempts or things like that has had to either make a decision about if they are going to fundamentally take military power into democratic public control or allow it to operate as, you know, a second shadow government, right? I don't know. It's just a serious question that I think a lot of people just like, they freak out whenever somebody talks about like reform, like as if the military is some, you know, essential, holy part of democracy that, you know, like how conservatives get worked about the Constitution, right? I'm just saying like leftists need to understand that like these things are serious questions. They're not just kind of, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing like from the sort of Enlightenment founding father area of social studies, you know, yeah, seventh exactly. grade, where it's like standing army is bad. Like let's bring that back, folks.
And, you know, and last thing too, just one thing that I thought was so, there's so many disgusting things that the coup government did. But one of the things that really fucking pissed me off was they destroyed the anti-imperialist military academy that Evo had been developing. Right, where people were basically like military commanders or people who were going to rise up into, you know, higher offices in the military were going to be educated in like anti-imperialism and like socialism and like Bolivar and like Fanon and all of these kind of, you know, really critical anti-imperialist leaders. And like one of the first things they did was eradicate that. So understand that the right wing is very afraid of these things, and they're right to be.
Yeah, that sounds like they should add like Daniel Bessner consult on that. Seems like the exact sort of thing you'd like. Let's get to cargo and Nestle.
Yeah, you're ready for this one. Well, if people haven't watched our show before, you might be unaware that Matt Leck and I are big opponents of the Supreme Court, an institution that has long shown its colors as not just an organization that doesn't stand for social justice and progress, but actually stands as one of the strongest bulwarks against social movements and progress in this country. I'll do my quick 45-second pitch on this. Every argument that you get from well-meaning liberals, right, that the Supreme Court is a critical institution in American democracy is fixated on this one line, right, that the Supreme Court's job is to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority. If you look at the actual record of the Supreme Court, you will find that that has never been the case. In fact, not only has the Supreme Court oftentimes been one of the cheerleaders of some of the worst aspects of American genocide and slavery, in fact, they have oftentimes increased the mandate of the federal government to enact these kind of crimes and atrocities, right? The minority that the Supreme Court has been willing to stand up for has always been the rich. And yes, are there some decisions that the Supreme Court makes that are positive? Sure. But it's always important to remember, especially if you consider yourself a Marxist, that these are not reflections of nine wise folks, but reflections of social movements on the ground changing the conditions around them. One fight that we are seeing right now that is absolutely critical is the fight for the fundamental right to abortion, right? And there is a very worrying reality that Roe v. Wade could get overturned, right? But look at the conditions even that brought Roe v. Wade into, you know, into being. Across the country, social movements were demanding that this right be recognized by their state governments. That got it to such a point that the federal government, that the Supreme Court weighed in on that. And one of the difficult things about Roe v. Wade was that it basically suspended that fight over our head, right? Instead of like allowing those movements to expand and entrench this right, it codified it in a fairly conservative reading too. You know, Roe v. Wade didn't say women have fundamental control over their bodies and no one has the right to tell them what to do. It said you have a right to privacy, right? So the point is that on all of these questions, right, there were social movements that forced their hand, right? And in a lot of ways, movements that have had to look towards the courts have unfortunately brought a lot of steam out of social movements. Regardless, while a lot of liberals are cheering today about the decision about Obamacare, right, which again is not a fundamental threat to American capital, it's been a great handout to the insurance industry. There has been another decision by the Supreme Court, which I think truly shows its colors. The Supreme Court threw out a lawsuit that alleged that two American companies, Nestle and Cargill, were participating knowingly in what they are calling human rights abuses, but let's call it what it is, child slavery on cocoa plantations in the Ivory Coast. And this was by a vote of 8-1. So despite the conservative bent of the Supreme Court now, after the GOP were able to steal a few justices, all of these other liberals were very happy to go along with this. And the argument is said, by the way, this was brought by 6 people, adults from Mali, who have claimed that as children they were enslaved in the Ivory Coast, and the conditions that they experienced were absolutely horrific. And it's undoubtable that Nestle and Cargill were well aware of the kind of activities that they were engaged in and what they were supporting, right? And this isn't, by the way, an indirect support. Like a lot of times you say like, oh, well, if you buy this, like, look at all the horrible things that this product does. And it's like, absolutely recognize it. But these are corporations that are like knowingly profiting and buying from sources that are using one of the most barbaric forms of enforced labor, that of children. The decision essentially, rested upon the idea that they have no standing in an American court of law, because of their lack of status as Americans, right? Despite the fact that the United States has shown itself time and time again to be a very willing participant in going after other, in seeing internationals and foreigners represented in their courts, if it's in the interest of capital. But when it is, people who were enslaved in their youth, they don't have the time of day for them. And this was an 8-1 decision, an 8-1 decision. So all of the memes about, these great liberal justices need to be put to rest. And this organization needs to be remembered and understood as what it is, which is a way for a ruling elite to be able to enforce their will on American democracy, despite having no real meaningful checks on it.
Yeah, you mentioned that the Supreme Court of the United States is bad. Also bad is the Supreme Court of the United States blog. They said this: "Now, do we say that Sonia Sotomayor and the other liberals supported child slavery by all voting for Nestle today? Of course not. And Nestle's lawyers, like Neil Katyal, obviously didn't either. The cheap attacks on the court and thoughtful lawyers did not age well." Let's just go back here to what my kind of lawyer says, respectable lawyer, says, "But they did support child slavery. They disregarded Nestle's domestic conduct in funding, training, and overseeing the slave plantations, classifying it as general corporate operations," which is a great euphemism, "ripping the teeth out of the alien tort statute and preventing accountability to U.S. courts," she goes on. "The Nestle opinion is repulsive and would have come out differently if the court wasn't full of pro-corporate psychos bred in America's major law firms. Worse yet, the opinion provides a roadmap for American importers to procure resources through slavery with legal impunity. Finally, I'm the first to admit the lunatic right-wing reactionaries on the court are a problem, but 9 liberal justices from Harvard and Yale won't save you from corporate domination of the law or repellent outcomes and demands." And one more just from Jez Bolsonaro: "Another victory for Obama appointing Neil Katyal, brought to you all by 3 Democratic Supreme Court judges." Mm-hmm. And also, this is just right. "Neil Katyal argued Nestle and Cargill cannot be held liable for abetting child slavery, noting that Nuremberg prosecutors did not charge the firm that produced Zyklon B gas for Nazis." So that is
incredible.
Law, American law.
What a tradition. And it should be noted that it was Samuel Alito who dissented.
Based Alito.
Which is like, throws a wrench in a lot of people's perspectives on these things. And Look, I just want
to... Do you think they just, like, pick names out of a hat? So, like, we can't go unanimously for this. We're all supportive of it, but we can't do it unanimously, or otherwise people are going to... So just pick names out and... All right, Alito, see what you can come up with. Why do you agree with that?
I mean, the thing is that, you know, I don't really like to do all these personal narratives for, you know, viewing politics, but it's only because the Supreme Court is such an insane personal organization.
It's like the divine right of kings. You need to.
People see their role as shaping the nation.
Yeah.
Right. So that is why you get some of these kind of funny things where there will be a conservative that, you know, tends to rule in a way that you would consider to be, you know, liberal and vice versa. Right. And fundamentally, I'll make an argument that might piss off some of our legal friends out there, you know, but if what you learn at these schools, especially the Ivy law schools, is how to make an argument within the accepted parameters of argument. Right. And in that case, that means, the U.S. legal system, right? The Constitution, blah, blah, right? And it's not people actually sitting here as like arbiters of, you know, right or wrong or anything like that. They recognize how they can use precedent, legal language, blah, 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 to get whatever result that they want, right?
Which is, law has been around since like the middle fucking ages, and that's always what it's been.
Yeah, exactly. Like this kind of idea that we have like these neutral judges out there who are just looking at the law and, you know, being impartial is complete BS. And I just wanted to note that, you know, if you look, for example, at like a lot of the most egregious court rulings around things like, you know, slavery or Jim Crow, all these other things, more often than not, the way that these systems were upheld were never so blunt as saying, we're just like the United States endorses racism. Right. It was a lot of procedural stuff to say like, oh, well, this person doesn't have standing in this court because of this and this and that reason, right? And that's essentially what this argument was. And just goes into a long line and tradition of SCOTUS ruling with the extremely rich and powerful. And in this case, against some of the most marginalized people that you could conceive of. It's an absolutely despicable organization in this context, and it's a threat to democracy, for fuck's sake. Like, take this seriously.
Right.
Just give up this bullshit. I mean, especially liberals, this like bullshit worship of the impartiality of the court. At least the right wing understands what it is.
Right. Absolutely.
We need to eradicate this idea that this is not a political arena. And, you know, whatever I know some people like strategies of packing, blah, blah, blah. I say, weaken its power as much as you feasibly can.
Yeah, it should be subservient to. It should not be an equal branch of government. To put it simply in Schoolhouse Rock terms. I had something else to say there, but I got distracted by my Schoolhouse Rock point. So, folks, let's. We're going to go to the post game, wherein we will be checking in with another hustle entrepreneur guy, Sweaty Startups, who set the internet ablaze with his tomato farming plan to. You know, success. So we're going to get it. That's going to be our bum steer. What else do we want to tease in the post game?
Tease and shout out. We'll be talking a little bit more in depth about this, but shout out to socialists winning in San Antonio. We're two socialists. We're elected to city council. We'll be talking a little bit about that briefly. And also what one of the conservative members sort of had a mask off moment and describe what exactly they think the role of the city council is, and much more. I mean, we got a lot of good stuff to get to in the post game. Actually, I'm really looking forward to it. So definitely consider joining us at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Some stuff to look forward to. We will be releasing, I think, in 2 weeks, but a conversation with our friend and comrade Megan Day about a Southern school for socialism that has been forgotten by the left. I'm really looking forward to that conversation and much more. So join us on the other side.
All right, folks. See you next time.